businesses so I could get to know some of you better, but I'll just have to come back at some point. So you have been meditating on the foolishness of the cross. And what I would like to do today, in light of the fact that we have a reading from the Gospel of John, is reflect a bit on the theme of the cross in the Gospel of John. And as you probably know, if you're familiar with the Gospels, John is sort of an outlier among the four Gospels. Let me make sure my mic is on here. Can all of you hear me okay? Okay, good deal. So what I've put on the screen here, this is a page from the Book of Kells, which is an Irish manuscript from the 800s. And you'll see it has four panels. You probably can't see it too well here, unfortunately. But if you Google it later, just Book of Kells, four Gospels, this will pop. You can't hear very well. How about that? There we go. Okay, fantastic. Thank you. So this is an image, I was saying, from the Book of Kells, which is an Irish manuscript. And you can see there are four different panels here representing the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John from the New Testament. And you can see that they each have a different creature that is within these panels. And this is a reflection of a rather strange Christian tradition that links the discussion of these four creatures in the Book of Revelation. The creatures are a lion, an ox, a man, and an eagle. And the tradition in the church was to link those creatures with one of the four Gospels. And it's a bit strange, it's a bit odd, but it also gives us a little bit of an insight into how each of the Gospels is distinct. So traditionally, the lion was associated with the Gospel of Mark. And you may remember that the Gospel of Mark begins with John the Baptist out in the wilderness. He's like a lion roaring out. You know, the kingdom of God is at hand. You need to get right with the Lord. The ox is a creature that is often linked to the Gospel of Luke. An ox was a sacrificial animal, and Luke, of course, opens with a priest named Zechariah, who is going in to make atonement for the people of Israel. The man, the figure of the man, is associated with Matthew, because Matthew's Gospel starts off with a genealogy, underscoring to us that Jesus is fully human. He entered into the human story. He has a history. He has relatives. And then finally, the eagle is the fourth creature, and the eagle is linked to the Gospel of John. And the reason for that is that the Gospel of John seems to soar high up into the heavenly realms. Think about how it doesn't start with a birth story of Jesus, the way Matthew and Luke do. Instead, John starts off by saying, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. All things came into being through him." So there's a sense in which John is going way up high and saying, if you really want to understand who Jesus is, you have to understand that he is the heavenly Son of the eternal Father. He is one with God. And part of the drama of the Gospel of John, part of the fun of reading it, is that we as the readers know that about Jesus, but not all the characters do. As we heard this morning, if you were in church already, or maybe you're going to be going into church, but we will be looking at the story of Jesus and Nicodemus. And part of the intrigue of that story is that Nicodemus doesn't quite know what to do with Jesus. And so there's this sense in which John, as the eagle, gives us a glimpse. We see who Jesus is, but the drama is being worked out in the lives of the characters. Now, you may say, well, why does John sound so different from the other Gospels? I don't know how much you've paid attention to this. There are some really strange things about the Gospel of John if you know the other Gospels. Like, for example, in the other Gospels, Jesus is most known for teaching in parables. Probably some of the best loved teachings of Jesus are his parables, like the parable of the prodigal son. this son who wanders away from home and the father welcomes him back. The parable of the Good Samaritan, you know, the good religious people pass by this guy who's lying on the side of the road, but it's the outsider, it's the despised Samaritan who's the one who actually stops and bandages his wounds. These are much loved stories of Jesus. We don't get any of that in the Gospel of John. We don't have a birth narrative. We don't have Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. We don't have the story of Jesus instituting the Eucharist on the night that he was betrayed. We don't have the story of Jesus being transfigured on the mountain. So why is John so different? Why does John stand out in this way? And I just want to mention one book that I have really enjoyed studying over the past few years. This is a book called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses by a retired British scholar named Richard Bauckham. He taught for many years at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. But what he argues in this book is that the author of the Gospel of John may not have been John, the son of Zebedee, as we traditionally think of the author, but it may have been another John. There was an early Christian named John the Elder. And Bauckham argues that the reason the Gospel of John sounds so different is that it goes back to this guy, John the Elder, who was a citizen of Jerusalem. So he would have had intimate acquaintance with the places and the people that Jesus spent his last hours with. He was there in the intimate moments at the trial. He was possibly related to the high priest, so he would have had access to the higher echelons of Jerusalem society. And really what he's doing is he is supplementing the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, which are relaying the memories of Peter and the others who were with Jesus. So this John the Elder says, I'm going to write a unique gospel. I'm going to write what one church father called a spiritual gospel to show you not just the actions of Jesus, not just the teachings of Jesus, but the interior life and identity of Jesus. Think about how John is the one who gives us that long prayer of Jesus on the night he's betrayed. John 17 is a very long chapter, and it's all prayer. It's all Jesus praying to the Father on our behalf. So if Bauckham is correct, we are really near the heart of a very important eyewitness testimony when we read this gospel. It actually gives me chills to think about it. That within just a few years after Jesus being killed and raised from the dead, this author wants to put in writing his memories, his eyewitness memories of Jesus. And so that's what we have in the Gospel of John. And you may notice that the author never really names himself. He uses this phrase, the disciple whom Jesus loved. And I wonder if part of the reason for that is he wants us to be able to identify with him. He's going to not even mention his name so that we can, in a sense, enter into his experience of knowing Jesus. We can sort of piggyback on him, so to speak, and rely on his memories to take us into a deeper awareness of who Jesus is for us. This beloved disciple, there's some really kind of interesting moments in this gospel. We learn that this beloved disciple was there at the Last Supper, leaning on Jesus' breast, it says. People back then didn't eat dinner with chairs like you're sitting in here. They would have reclined sort of on their elbows. And so this beloved disciple is right there reclining next to Jesus, you know, dipping his bread in the same dish that Jesus is using. There's an intimate familiarity there. And then sort of funny, on Easter morning, it says that this beloved disciple was running with Peter to the tomb to find out if it really was empty. And he says he got there first, but he didn't go in. He let Peter be the one to go in, but he wants you to know he got there first. So he saw it with his own eyes. The tomb is empty. Jesus is alive. And he comes and puts all of this testimony into this gospel for us. It's also very interesting. He seems to have worked hard at crafting this gospel. It's very literary. It's artistic. And it remains, for many people, their favorite of the four Gospels. I'm just curious, would anybody say John is your favorite of the four Gospels? Some hands here, yeah. And you also may know that there are several Christian publishers that have published just a little edition of the Gospel of John without any of the other New Testament writings. And you can fit it in your pocket, And some people will sort of keep a stash of these in their car in case they end up, you know, talking to someone who wants to know Jesus, and they can just hand them a copy of the Gospel of John. I think Billy Graham used to do that at his Billy Graham Crusades as well. So John is beloved. John is a literary masterpiece. And John claims to be someone who can lead us into the heart of who Jesus is. I just want to mention a few of the ways that John is very artistic, and then I want to zero in on what John says about the cross, the foolishness of the cross. One of the ways that we see the artistry of John is that he loves symbolic numbers. A lot of biblical authors do this, but John seems especially fond of the number seven, which is, of course, 7 days is the original week of creation. It's the number of perfection, the symbolic number of perfection in the Bible. And so John will play with this number seven. For example, he has seven statements of Jesus where Jesus identifies himself with the phrase, I am. He says, first, I am the bread of life. Remember how he multiplies the loaves and the fishes for his followers. He says that bread that you ate is meant to point to me. I am the bread of life. He says, I am the light of the world. He says, I am the door of the sheep. He is the one guarding the sheep. He says, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. He says, I am the resurrection and the life. That's a climactic moment in the Gospel of John when his friend Lazarus has died. And Jesus, intentionally, it seems, stays away for a few days because he knows that he's going to go to Bethany and he's going to raise Lazarus from the dead and he's going to manifest his glory in that way. And so by waiting a few days, he underscores his awesome, almighty power to do what no one else could do. The sisters even say, Lord, you can't ask us to roll away the stone because the corpse is going to be stinking by now. And Jesus says, that's how powerful my resurrection power is. Even though the corpse has begun to decay, I can bring new life again. I am the resurrection and the life. He says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And then climactically and finally, on the night of his trial and arrest, he says, I am the true vine. And he describes us as the branches that are partaking of the vine. We are united to Jesus so that his life becomes our life. So there are seven of these altogether, seven I am statements. And very interestingly, there are also seven so-called signs in the Gospel of John. John loves that word, signs. The other Gospels talk about Jesus doing miracles, or mighty deeds, we might call it, dunamis in the Greek. But John doesn't use that language. John instead calls Jesus' mighty actions signs. And he says these signs are to show or to manifest his glory. That's another important word that we'll come to in just a moment. And the first of these signs is one of the most beloved. It's the story of Jesus going to this wedding party and they run out of wine. Absolute disaster at a wedding, right? And his mother comes and says, do something about this. And he does. He takes these six stone water jars, each of which holds about 30 gallons of water. We're talking about a lot of water. And he turns those into the best wine the people have ever had. And John, the narrator, tells us this was the first of Jesus' signs that he did in Cana of Galilee to manifest his glory. So the signs are about glory. And he tells us this is the first one. Then we come in a couple chapters later to this Jewish official. His son has fallen ill, and he comes to Jesus to ask for his son to be cured. And Jesus does it even at a geographical distance. He's not even with the boy. But at the very hour that he speaks the word, the servants say that's when the boy started to get well. So even over a vast terrain of distance, Jesus can exercise his healing power. And John, the narrator, tells us this was now the second of Jesus' signs. So you've heard there's one, now there's two. So what does that do for us as readers? It makes us want to start counting. How many of these are there going to be? And the narrator doesn't do it for us anymore after the second one. He just expects us to keep track on our own. And lo and behold, if you start keeping track, the number comes out to seven. I don't think accidentally. He heals a lame man. That's the third one. He multiplies the loaves and the fishes for the crowds. That's the fourth one. He heals a man that has been blind from birth. Again, underscoring the dramatic nature of these signs. He's not just blind because of an accident in his adulthood. He actually was never able to see. And Jesus is able to grant him sight even so. And then, ultimately, climactically, Lazarus is raised from the dead. Now, if you're keeping track, the raising of Lazarus from the dead is the sixth sign. So if you know your biblical number symbolism, you know six is not a great number. There needs to be seven. We need to have the complete set. So John is, in a sense, asking you to reflect, what is the seventh sign that Jesus is going to do to manifest his glory? And it looks like there won't be one, because after Lazarus is raised from the dead, that's when Jesus is in Jerusalem. He is unjustly arrested. He's put through a sham trial, which is a total mockery of justice, and he's condemned to death. And you're sort of left hanging. What's the seventh sign going to be? And it's very interesting that N.T. Wright, the great New Testament scholar, has argued that John seems to be pressing us to see a sign of Jesus' glory in the most unlikely place, which is the cross. And you might say, how in the world can the cross be a sign of Jesus' glory? That is the exact opposite of what a crucifixion is. You all know this, but I think it's just worth our reminding ourselves this morning that the cross was a Roman device to make your death as publicly humiliating as possible. It's to deprive you of glory. It's to strip you of dignity. Yes, there's the physical torture of it, but that doesn't seem to be what the New Testament emphasizes most. What it seems to emphasize most is the utter shame of the cross. Your clothes are removed. You're impaled in a very public place where people can walk by and see you gasping for air. You're totally stripped of all your dignity. And that's where we're supposed to see glory? That's sort of the question that John leaves us hanging with. And I'd like to just reflect with you very briefly on a couple of passages where Jesus makes this explicit. So we've heard one of them in church this morning. Jesus says to Nicodemus, just as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up, so that whoever believes in him may have eternal life. Now that language of lifting up, that's synonymous in the Gospel of John with the language of being glorified. To be exalted, to be lifted up is to be glorified. And what Jesus seems to be saying is that his moment of supreme glory, his moment when you're going to see him exalted and lifted high, is quite literally when he is hoisted up from the earth on a pole and crucified. Deeply paradoxical, because we would say that's the height of humiliation. But John says, no. Yes, it is. It is humiliation. But the moment of Jesus' humiliation is the greatest moment of his glory. It's the moment when he's exalted. Another example of this, Jesus is talking to the crowds in chapter 8, and in verse 28, he says, when you have lifted up the Son of Man, then you will realize that I am, and that I do nothing on my own, but I speak these things as the Father has instructed me. He's saying, you hostile crowds are going to soon lift me up in the shame of the crucifixion. But what's going to happen when you do that is my very deity. I am who I am. That's the language that God uses in the Old Testament to identify himself. Jesus says, when you've lifted me up on the cross, you're going to realize that I am. In other words, I am the one true God who is laying down my life for you. You're not taking it from me. I am voluntarily laying it down so that you might be saved. And then one more text that I think is very important for this is in chapter 12. And Jesus says again, and I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. And then the narrator says to us, Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death he was to die. The crowd answered him, "We've heard from the law that the Messiah remains forever. How can you say that the Son of Man must be lifted up?" And this gets us into the deepest irony of the Gospel of John, which is that when they perform that act of degradation and shame, that is, in God's eyes, the exalting of Jesus for the life of the world. Couple more texts, and then I want to try to draw some threads together here. So in chapter 12, as Jesus is setting his face to endure the cross, he says, "The hour has now come for the Son of Man to be glorified." You remember all the way back at the beginning of the signs, his mother comes to him and says, "Can you please take care of this wine shortage at the wedding?" And he says to her initially, "My hour has not yet come. It's not the hour yet for my glorification." Now he says in chapter 12, "My hour has come. The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified." And then one chapter later, after he's washed his disciples' feet, he says this, "Now the Son of Man has been glorified, and God has been glorified in him. If God has been glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself, and will glorify him at once." And immediately after that comes the trial and the execution of Jesus on the cross, which I think we're meant to see as the fulfillment of those words that Jesus spoke on that night. This is how God is glorifying Jesus. It looks for all the world like shame and humiliation, but for those with eyes to see what's actually happening, God is glorifying his Son so that the world might be saved, so that anyone who turns away from their sin and casts themselves on the mercy of God in Christ will be delivered. I want to show you a couple of art pieces that I think illustrate this very powerfully. Some of you may know this piece. This is called the Eisenheim Altarpiece. It is now housed in a museum in Colmar in France. This was originally painted by an artist named Matthias Grunewald to be literally an altarpiece. There at the altar, the priest would be facing this as he says Mass. And this was put in a hospital. And you probably can't see it too well. I'd encourage you to Google it when you get home. But the imagery here of Jesus suffering is pretty grotesque. You can see his lips are sort of green from lack of oxygen. His skin is sort of pierced with all these little bits of what look like thorns or bits of wood, something like this. And the hospital where this was originally housed was a hospital for folks who had a skin condition that they didn't know the source of at the time. Turns out they were eating a type of wheat that was causing skin lesions for them. It was a dietary problem, but it was very painful. And I can imagine the patients in this hospital sort of looking at this image of Christ and thinking to themselves, "Christ knows what I'm going through. He's been through it too. He has skin lesions like I have skin lesions. He knows what this pain feels like." But here's the interesting thing about this piece to me. On the right-hand side of Jesus' body, basically this portion of his shoulder, there's a seam running vertically down the middle so that the panels of this altarpiece could be opened up, and there was another painting underneath it. So this would have been what you would see during the season of Lent, but as Lent came to an end, the panels would be opened, and you would see this. This is the risen Christ. You can see the nail marks in his hands. You can't see them there in his feet, but they are there. And I like to think that the artist is doing something really theologically compatible with the Gospel of John here. Because what he's doing is he's saying, if you want to understand the glorification of the Easter Jesus, you have to pass through the humiliation of the Good Friday Jesus. You have to pass through that seam in the painting. If you want to encounter the exalted, glorified life of Jesus, you get there through the cross. The cross is the way in which Jesus is glorified. Let me show you another piece. This is from a parish, Anglican parish in London, St. Paul's Lorimer Square. The artist here is a woman named Frida Skinner. And you can see she's done something very interesting with this piece. There's a painting of Jesus' shadow on the crossbeams. And you can see the nails piercing his hands and his feet. But juxtaposed on top of the shadow is the Easter Jesus, the risen Lord. And it's hard to tell whether the rays that are emanating from his head, are those thorns from the crown of thorns, or are those rays of light from the halo of his glorification? And I think that ambiguity is part of the point. This sculpture is saying to me what the Eisenheim altarpiece is saying, which is that if you want to encounter the splendor and the exaltation and the glory of Jesus, you have to see that as bound up with the humiliation and the suffering that he endured on our behalf. You don't get to encounter the Easter glory without the Good Friday suffering, nor do you get to encounter the Good Friday suffering apart from understanding it as glory. There's that seam that allows you to pass through the one to the other. And that, my friends, is, I think, what John is up to in his gospel. He wants us to see the crucifixion of Jesus not as defeat, ultimately, not as humiliation, ultimately, but what human beings intended as humiliation, God turned to exaltation. God turned to glory. And that, I think, is what this season that we're in is all about. We are preparing ourselves to journey with Jesus to Jerusalem. I personally, for years, have liked to think of this season of Lent and Holy Week and Eastertide as our being given an opportunity to keep company with Jesus, to just slow down, read the Gospels again, meditate on this life. Who was this person? Get to know him. Again, read slowly and lovingly through the Gospels and see how it all culminates at Good Friday on the cross and Easter Sunday. One New Testament scholar has said that the Gospels, each of the Gospels, including the Gospel of John, is essentially a passion story, meaning a story of suffering with a long introduction. In other words, the real weight, the center of gravity in the Gospels is this moment. It's this moment when human beings do their worst, and God takes it and makes it the means of glory. And where I think this gets really practical for you and me is that we all have those areas and places in our lives which feel like utter shameful defeat. Maybe it's a physical ailment that we wish were not constantly present with us. Maybe it's a psychological ailment. Maybe it's a relational difficulty. And we think there's no way that anything other than degradation can be present here. But if we believe the story of Jesus, God takes degradation and makes it glorification. God takes wounds and makes them to be vehicles of his light and his healing. And that, I think, is what we're being invited into. That's the paradox of the cross. The foolishness of the cross turns out to be the wisdom of God. So we have a few more minutes. I don't know if you all typically do Q&A in this sort of setting, but I would love to hear any comments or questions that people have. I assume you'll just need to shout it out loud. We probably don't have a microphone that is running, but any comments or questions? Yes, in the back. Yeah. So the comment was, she would have thought that the resurrection, Easter Sunday, would have been the seventh sign. And that very well may be. I sometimes tell my students it could be like crucifixion hyphen resurrection, like they're smushed together. N.T. Wright has made the proposal, which I think is fascinating, that the resurrection is actually the eighth sign. Now, if you know your symbolism, the eighth day, according to the church fathers, is the day of new creation. So the original creation has 7 days, right? And if we're tracking with that, Jesus would have been lying in the tomb resting on the Sabbath day, the seventh day. When he's raised on Easter Sunday, that's the start of the new week. In other words, it's the eighth day after the original seven. In other words, it's the day of the new creation. God is now launching a new creation, which surpasses the original creation, which he made in 7 days. So I don't know if that's right, but I think it's beautiful all the same. So other comments or questions? Yes, here. Yeah. Yeah. So great question. Why did Jesus say, my God, why have you forsaken me on the cross? I think the first thing to think about there is that those words are from the Psalms. That's from Psalm 22, which means that Jesus isn't only coming up with his own cry. He's entering into the cry that the people of Israel have already been praying for centuries. In other words, what he's doing, I think, in that moment of anguish and suffering, he's identifying himself with the anguished prayers of humanity. He's saying, you feel forsaken by God, I feel that too. I'm there with you. It's a profound solidarity. It's not, I think, that he's actually, as the second person of the Trinity, separate from his Father. That would be impossible. His Father has not forsaken him, but he enters into that human experience of feeling abandoned. And I think if any of us are honest, we probably have those moments in our Christian life where it just feels like, God, you're not there. You're not real. You're not showing up for me. And I think what Jesus is saying is that human experience is not alien to him. He shares that with us. And of course, God's ultimate answer to him is to raise him from the dead. He hasn't forsaken him, but he does allow his son in his humanity to share that experience of anguish. That's probably the best I can do there. It's a really profound question. There was another hand over here somewhere, I thought. Maybe not. Yes. Yes. Yes.
That he is the Messiah. Whereas in all the others, they have to discover it 3 years later.
Yes. Yes. So if you didn't hear, the question is, if you're reading Matthew, Mark, and Luke, which are called the Synoptic Gospels, Jesus' Messiahship is something they don't understand until the very end. And in fact, Mark makes it even more kind of dramatic, because it's not even the disciples who get it. It's the centurion at the cross. He's the one who finally says, truly, this man was the Son of God. Whereas in John, it seems like Jesus is revealed to be the Messiah from the beginning. I think one way of thinking about that is that if scholars are correct that the Gospel of John was written last, so Matthew, Mark, and Luke came first, and John, if Richard Baucom is correct that John is written by an eyewitness, this gospel may be saying, okay, you know the way things have been narrated by Matthew, Mark, and Luke. That's true. That's how it happened. But what I want to do is kind of pull back the curtain and show you who Jesus was all along. So he's kind of, in a sense, supplementing or reimagining the story that everyone's already familiar with. This is why Clement of Alexandria, one of the early Christians, he said, the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they treat of the bodily actions of Jesus, but the fourth gospel treats of his spirit. It's a spiritual gospel. So it's trying to show you this is who he really is. So I appreciate that leaves us with a bit of tension, but I think that's probably what's going on there spiritually and theologically. It's a good question. Others, yes. Yes. Yep. Yep. It's a great question. So the question is about the differing chronologies. So in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus has a meal on Thursday evening, Maundy Thursday, which is the day of Passover. So it's a Passover meal that he is now reinterpreting as being about himself. So he is actually the bread that is given for the life of the world. His blood is the drink that will lead to everlasting life. Whereas in John's gospel, it says that the Passover lambs are being slaughtered on Friday, the day that he's crucified. So whatever he did on Thursday night couldn't have been a Passover because the Passover hasn't happened yet. My own opinion is that John is probably closer to the historical reality, that meal that Jesus had on Thursday was kind of a pre-Passover. It was Jesus essentially saying, let me interpret for you what Passover is actually all about, even though in terms of historical chronology, the actual feast hadn't yet taken place. And the reason I think John underscores that is because John is the one who has John the Baptist say at the very beginning, "Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." In other words, John is wanting us to see that when the Passover lambs are being slaughtered at the temple, the real Passover lamb is being killed on the cross outside the city gates. That's my best effort there. It's a great question. We probably have time for one or two more. Any comments or questions? Yes.
So, John the Elder, are you suggesting or perhaps stating he writes the book of John? It's not John the Apostle who writes this book of John, and therefore, then who writes Revelation?
It's a really good question. So tradition, up before the modern era, would say the author of the gospel, the author of the epistles, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, and the author of Revelation, all one person. It's John, the son of Zebedee, you know, who is one of Jesus' three closest followers, Peter, James, and John. James and John were actually brothers. More recent scholarship has questioned that. And so that's where I was mentioning Richard Baucom. He argues that it's a different John, but it's not a John who is far removed from the situation. It's John who is very present, you know, a Jerusalem apostle. So, you know, I this is the kind of thing that historians argue about. I don't think we can know for sure. I do think Baucom makes a pretty good case. Revelation is interesting because it certainly sounds a lot like John in a lot of ways, and the author identifies himself as John, but we don't know that it's the same John. So I just think we have to live with a bit of ambiguity there. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you all so much. It's really a joy to be with you.